WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 7 of Pulse of the Nation. And if it's Friday, you know what that means. It's time for your news flash. Now, an update on everything that's been going on with the podcast. I said that this week we would be doing something about the Republican case for victory in 2024. That gets moved back to next week. We had a bit of trouble securing a guest, but we have secured a guest, and he'll be here with us next week to give that case. So now on to the news flash. We're going to start out in Alabama because a lot of electoral news has broken in Alabama. And I'll get to the maps later. But first, there were a couple of special primaries to talk about. So there's House District 16. That is Fayette, Northern Tuscaloosa, and rural West Jefferson counties. It is north of the University of Alabama's campus and is a very heavily Republican district. House District 16. The former representative, Kyle South, left this post to take a job as the head or the CEO of the West Alabama Chamber of Commerce, and thus there were six Republicans that ran to replace him. One Democrat did file, so there will be a general election, a competitive general election on January the 9th, 2024. But Tuesday, there was a primary that was held, and it will go to a runoff on October the 24th, so just a few short weeks from here. The two contestants in that runoff will be Fayette County Commissioner Brad Cox. He finished in first place by 15 votes with 32.96% of the vote, 1,216 votes. And the other candidate is a Tuscaloosa Municipal Court judge by the name of Brian Brignac with 32.56% of the vote or 1,201 votes. Of course, the runoff will be on October 24th, and whoever wins that runoff will be a very heavy favorite. Cox will be looking for a home boost in Fayette County, the same for Brignac and Tuscaloosa. So my analysis here is whoever wins the part of rural West Jefferson that's in House District 16 is probably going to win the primary and probably going to become the next representative of House District 16. We move on to House District 55, where not a long time Democratic representative, but a Democratic representative nonetheless by the name of Fred Plump had to resign as part of a plea deal for charges of conspiracy to defraud the Jefferson County Community Service Fund and for obstruction of justice. Now, this covers central Jefferson County from Fairfield all the way to downtown Birmingham, minor, and areas east. It is over 60% black by voting age population. That will become important as we go into the runoff because there was a runoff here. And the leading candidate, Travis Hendricks, only got 27.91% of the vote. He only got 670 votes. So yes, these special elections have pretty low turnout. And you saw the House District 16 turnout was bad. The District 55 turnout was even worse. So 670 votes get you a pretty comfortable first place in the runoff. So that's what Travis Hendricks got. He is a Birmingham police sergeant from Ensley, the west side of House District 55. And he will be seen as a favorite over Sylvia Swain, who got second place in the runoff, 515 votes, 21.45%. As of right now, she is 30 votes ahead of Phyllis Odin Jones, who got 20.2% of the vote, 485 votes. But it will be a runoff between Hendricks and Swain. Sylvia Swain actually graduated from the University of Alabama 4 years ago with a bachelor's in English. So she was a former organizer with Students for Fair Labor and other like-minded organizations. And she moved to House District 55 just a few years ago. If Sylvia Swain is elected, she would become the first ever trans elected official in the state of Alabama. So there's potentially extra national significance on this extremely low turnout special election. Of course, there will be a runoff on October 24th. As Travis Hendricks is black and Sylvia Swain is white, I think Travis Hendricks does have the edge here because it is an over 60% black voting age population district. The two candidates will have their voting bases in Travis Hendricks has the west part of the district. Sylvia Swain has the east part of the district. And the east part of the district has UAB in it. So obviously turnout is going to be down the drain, as it usually is with college area precincts, where a lot of students are registered to vote, not in the precinct of the college, but in their home areas, in their home states. So again, that will be very interesting to see how that goes. Plus, the west part of the district, which is like 90% black, has more population than the east side of the district, downtown Birmingham, UAB areas like that. So right now, I see Travis Hendricks as a favorite, but who knows? Special elections can get very wonky, and we will absolutely be following these elections as the month of October goes on. Now, the second part I want to talk about Alabama before we get to the main part of the newsflash is a special master. He proposed three maps to submit to the courts to see if they would get approved, and all three of those maps do have a second congressional district where black candidates could reliably get elected, where black voters reliably could elect their candidate of choice, particularly in presidential election style environments. Now, the 2022 midterm environment, which had black turnout even worse than in 2014, gets a little bit iffy because in all three the Republican candidates and for Senate and governor would have been able to win that second district, albeit narrowly. But, you know, given that that second district is going to be in place, it is going to be from Mobile to Montgomery, and it is going to cover into Russell County. It may go into Henry County and Dothan. It might not. It depends on which map the courts approve. But the Supreme Court did deny an appeal from the state of Alabama to stay the maps getting submitted and whatnot. So what do we know is that there will be a second black majority or equivalent congressional district in the state of Alabama. That will be a likely loss for the Republican Party, and it will be a likely gain for the Democratic Party. Of course, this has national implications for who controls the United States House. It might also have implications for the lawsuit to get Louisiana a second black majority district. You can draw one from you know, Monroe to East Baton. East Baton Rouge Parish and the city of Baton Rouge. So it'll be very interesting to see how that goes as well. I think there may also be a lawsuit in South Carolina because they think the black majority district there, which Jim Clyburn represents, is essentially packing black voters in the area, and they want North Charleston to be in the first district as opposed to, I believe, it's the sixth district that Clyburn represents. So it could become a bit more competitive. That would become a bit more competitive for Democrats down the line. Of course, I'll update y'all on everything, but the one thing I do want to talk about in regards to Tuscaloosa, I don't know and I cannot confirm which precincts are put in the 4th District, which is a supermajority white Republican district held by Robert Adelholt, and the 7th District, which is represented by Terry Sewell, of course, a Democrat. But I think that the city of Tuscaloosa has been put in the 4th District, which I don't get because the Republican Party did this, if I remember correctly. That's the same slip the Republican Party had in their blatantly illegal map, which openly defied the Supreme Court. But what I don't get is, one, did the special master put Tuscaloosa in the 4th? And if so, does that screw with the population mechanics, the population deviations of those districts? Because it very well could. Like, I do need to see more on that before I pass judgment on the maps. Like, in regards to getting a second black majority district, the special master, I think, did his job well. Obviously, Joe Reed disagrees with me, and I need to get into this next part because Joe Reed, the leader of the Alabama Democratic Conference and basically the puppet master of the Alabama Democratic Party state apparatus, he is apparently going to appeal this map on the fact that he doesn't think that second district in any of the three maps would get the job done. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. You know, there's possibilities that, you know, in a 2022 style turnout environment, Republicans could be competitive and win, and well, in legalese terms, black voters would not be able to elect the candidate of their choice. And what Joe Reed wants is, instead of like a 50% black voting age population district, he wants a 54% black VAP district, stretching from Mobile to Montgomery, and that being the second black majority district. So he will file an appeal. We'll hear more about that in probably next week's newsflash, if we're being honest. Maybe in two weeks we'll hear about that, but you know, there is that to go on. There is also, I think, legal precedent in the Supreme Court for, you know, you have to account for all turnout environments, and because you have the 2022 turnout environment, you could maybe build a case that there needs to be a higher black voting age population in order for that district to, you know, basically 95 or 100 times out of 100 elect the candidate of black voters' choice. But we'll see how that goes, and we'll see what eventually gets put out. When the final map does get put out, when it becomes law, I will do a deep dive on that second congressional district, what it looks like, who could run, and you know, I will also talk about the seventh district here, because I need to ask Bobby Singleton something. He is the Senate Minority Leader for the Democratic Party. He's from Hale County, he's from Greensboro. And I read something in Politico that apparently he's going to try and primary Terry Sewell. Why? I legitimately do not understand. Because in all three of the special counsel's maps, like, Terry Sewell, like, here's the thing. There was questions over which district Terry Sewell would run in. Would she run in a Birmingham area district, or would she run, you know, in the second district, because there are questions over where Selma would be. Well, and Selma is, you know, where she's from and where her church is. But both Birmingham and Selma are in the same district. So there's no question of where Terry Sewell's going to run. She's going to run in the 7th district. But, and also Hale County, where Greensboro is, in all three maps, it's also in the 7th district. So I don't know what Bobby Singleton thinks he's doing, but if you're legitimately trying to challenge Terry Sewell, you're going to get destroyed. Like, I don't... Terry Sewell is a very strong electoral performer in the state of Alabama. Even in 2022, I think she ended up either outrunning Biden or being very close to it. Like, I don't know if this is an issue he has with her constituent services. I don't know if this is an issue he has with her personally. I don't know if he has inside information that suggests that Terry Sewell might not run in 2024, although I really doubt it, because Representative Sewell was one of the strongest voices for a second black majority district, even if that would make her district less black by voting age population. But I honestly don't know what Bobby Singleton's thinking. Like, if he's actually going to challenge Terry Sewell in a primary, as far as I'm concerned, that could be the end of his political career. And I legitimately have no good reason as to why he would do that. No good reason whatsoever. So that's about 13 minutes of rambling about Alabama politics. So let's get into national politics, where you have DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announcing an 18-month temporary protected status extension for nearly 500,000 Venezuelan migrants. This allows them to get work permits and stuff like that. And it comes on the heels of the migrant crisis, which the Republican Party has been bashing Biden over the head with, and also the situations in New York City, where Eric Adams and Kathy Hochul have essentially cried out for help. And, you know, this also goes within, you know, what Greg Abbott has done, but with the razor wires and the saw boobies on the border and the Rio Grande and stuff like that. That's a long developing story, and there will absolutely be more in the next several months, as that might be a hot issue amongst conservative leading voters in 2024. Speaking of hot button issues, gun violence. And the Biden administration has decided it might want to do a tad bit about that, because over the week, they announced the creation of a new gun violence prevention office. Now, this office will be run by Vice President Kamala Harris, and it stems from a bill that was filed, I think, in March by freshman Representative Maxwell Frost from Orlando, Florida. He's a Democrat, and he ran, you know, as a result of the Bulls nightclub shooting and other shootings in the Orlando area, and of course the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Parkland in South Florida. And Frost was able to get elected office based on, you know, running on gun violence prevention. So it's a huge win for him, a huge win for, you know, Moms Demand Action and other, you know, pro assault weapons ban groups and stuff of that nature. So be interesting to see how that goes. Be interesting to see how the Biden administration, the Biden election team, respond to gun violence and what the policy is going to be for the Biden agenda in 2024, or at least what they're going to run on. But moving on now to a big story that, you know, occurred at Fox News in the past week. Rupert Murdoch has resigned. He has left his post as chairman of Fox News, and that will be taken over by his son, Lachlan. I can't really get into Rupert Murdoch all that much, but he was a highly influential figure in Fox News becoming what it is today, a arch-conservative news programming network that has given rise to the likes of Bill O'Reilly, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and, you know, most of the conservative figures that people know and some love and some absolutely despise. So we'll see, you know, how Lachlan's tenure goes, how he's going to run Fox News, and it'll be interesting to see how Fox News, you know, evolves with Lachlan's leadership, especially after all the lawsuits that Fox News has faced over, you know, the election denialism that occurred there in 2020 and 2021, you know, and all the money that they have had to pay out to, like, Dominion voting systems. I covered that last semester, I believe, at the end of the last semester. There was a huge lawsuit where Fox News had made a ton of money, and people were speculating that's part of the reason why Tucker Carlson got let go. But that's speculation, and I am going to leave it there. So, Saturday's episode. I'll get into Kevin McCarthy once again. Yes, I know it's a bit repetitive, but I'm going to focus on the motion to vacate. I'm going to focus on what would happen should a motion to vacate pass, and what are the rules in order to file a motion to vacate, what could happen if, you know, the motion to vacate passes, and it's a giant mess. But to be honest, so is the House of Representatives right now. As, look, there are at least 8 no votes on the Republican side on any continuing resolution to fund the government. And obviously, Democrats aren't going to support a continuing resolution that has basically a bunch of conservative wish list policies, like, you know, border security, you know, build the wall, but don't build the wall, build a bunch of razor wire and stuff like that. Bunch of, you know, not really booby traps, but a bunch of stuff to prevent migrants from crossing into the United States, and a bunch of other, like, anti-woke policies as well, which, you know, Biden and House Democrats and the Senate are never going to support. Because may we remind ourselves once again, the Senate is controlled by Democrats. And Chuck Schumer is never going to allow anything the House of Representatives might pass onto the Senate floor for a vote. That gets tossed into his incinerator. So, let me put this in perspective. The House Republicans, and, well, particularly Kevin McCarthy, he cannot pass a continuing resolution that would be dead in the Senate anyways. So now, because of this, the Senate has a lot of leverage because they passed something. They at least passed something. And the White House endorsed that bipartisan proposal. So now Chuck Schumer has more leverage than he had with the debt limit thing, because you essentially had to accept what Biden and Kevin McCarthy came up with. Now it's Biden, Schumer, and McCarthy. So, well, assuming McCarthy stays Speaker, there is a pretty significant chance that he might not be the end of be Speaker by the end of the year, or even the end of October. Like, it is bad in the U.S. House of Representatives. But moving on to Pennsylvania, where David McCormick, who narrowly lost a 2022 U.S. Senate primary to Dr. Mehmet Oz, he is running for Senate in 2024 against Senator Bob Casey. And he is all but going to be the presumptive GOP nominee. Every single Pennsylvania House Republican endorsed him, and it looks like he's going to be the guy to take on Bob Casey, which, let me be completely honest here, if you're in a swing state that's probably going to decide who becomes president in 2020, and so many people do not want to run against Bob Casey because of Casey's electoral strength that they nominate a man who mostly lives in Connecticut to run in Pennsylvania's primary, then there are issues afoot with the Pennsylvania GOP. And it might mostly be due to Casey's strength as a candidate, as a senator, but really, you couldn't find some random guy from Pennsylvania to take, who's lived in Pennsylvania all his life, to take on Bob Casey. Seriously? They first Dr. Oz in New Jersey, now Dave McCormick in Connecticut. Good Lord. They're going to nominate someone from Massachusetts next. I can just see it happening. Speaking of Pennsylvania senators and the guy that Dr. Oz lost to by 5 points, there is a lot of hullabaloo, or whatever, however you pronounce that word, about John Fetterman and his fashion choices. To put it simply, he does not like suits. And a lot of people in the Senate do not like the fact that John Fetterman does not like to wear suits. He presided over the Senate in his usual attire, which is just a shirt and shorts. So Joe Manchin, he got all riled up about it. He filed a Shorts Act to essentially force John Fetterman to wear a suit. And Fetterman has, well, let me just say this. He is one of the guys that gets the right wing the maddest. And I'm not entirely sure why. I would love to know why. Is it because they think he's a potato? Is it because they think he defiles the Senate? And, or whatever it is. Or maybe it's a combination of multiple factors. I legitimately don't know. But, you know, as of the day of recording, John Fetterman, he did say during a Democratic lunch, so this is the news that broke on Punchbowl News a few hours ago, actually 2 hours before I started speaking on this. He said that he will wear a suit when he's speaking or when he's presiding over the chamber. If he's not in a suit, he will vote for in the cloakroom, per sources familiar with the discussion. This is from Heather Cagle, who I believe is a UA alum as well and works for Punchbowl News. So you have that to go on, and hopefully this ends this what I believe to be essentially a nonsensical discussion. Now, a lot of people on the left love John Fetterman for this. I don't know as well. I have a lot of trouble discovering why this is. It's a multitude of factors. At least I can understand it more. It's part of because I think he is a world-class hater, one of the only true posters and haters in the United States Senate. Like, John Fetterman, it's he and his Senate staff do not care. They will roast anybody and everybody. And John Fetterman will even make fun of himself and his fashion choices as well, as he's done repeatedly over the past week. I might do an entire episode on him. I don't know. Like, it's really, really, really interesting to see how this dynamic is working. For a freshman senator to be this nationally known usually does not happen. And it is very interesting to, you know, sort of examine how that happens. But moving on. Because there was an interesting breaking news that happened in the House. And no, it does not have to do with Kevin McCarthy being unable to run an offense better than the Bears are, let alone the House of Representatives. But this goes to Indiana, where an interesting scheme, and interesting is not a good word to describe this, let's be honest, it's shenanigans. So a GOP congressman by the name of Jim Baird has apparently decided he's not going to run for re-election in 2024. That's fine enough. What isn't fine is essentially he's trying to hand off the seat to his son. So he's not only trying to retire, but he's trying to time his departure so his son can succeed him without having to face a primary. But Jim Baird has already filed to run for re-election. So what he's trying to do here is that Jim Baird could essentially announce his retirement on the filing deadline in Indiana, which is February the 9th, which could make it difficult to anyone without advanced knowledge during the race. And this source that Daily Kos has says, quote, alternatively, he could do so after winning a primary on May the 7th, which would empower party officials to pick a new nominee, i.e. Jim Baird's son, which is Bo Baird. And I think Bo is a state representative, I think. He's in the Indiana State Legislature. But this Jim Baer thing, it's not the first time this has happened. It's not going to be the last time. You had, in 2004 in Illinois, when Democratic Representative Bill Lipinski won nomination for a 12th term despite a lot of rumors over his impending retirement. Then he declared months later he was going to call it quits. And so party leaders were tasked with picking his replacement. That included Bill Lipinski, and they went for his son, Dan. And Dan stayed in office until 2019, because in 2018 he was primaried by Marie Newman, a far more progressive candidate. Dan Lipinski was one of the most conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives. And, of course, Dan Lipinski was also hostile to abortion rights. So, if you're hostile to abortion rights in the Democratic Party and you're not from the rural South or from South Texas, then you're getting nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. And that's an example that worked. Sometimes this doesn't work. In 2008, a Kentucky representative by the name of Ron Lewis told House Republicans he planned to run again. He filed re-election papers. But someone at the NRCC got clued in that Ron Lewis was just telling a bunch of lies. And they wanted to make sure that State Senator Brett Guthrie was prepared to put his own name forward in case Ron Lewis tried to pull off those shenanigans. So, essentially, the wife of Ron Lewis's chief of staff, who was Daniel London, turned in candidacy papers on behalf of her husband and a separate set to remove Lewis's name from the ballot. But Brett Guthrie was waiting, and with just 1 minute to spare, he handed his own forms before submitting the requisite $500 check you need to file for elections in Kentucky just 5 seconds before the filing window closed. And then Daniel London ended his campaign a short time later, and Brett Guthrie is still in the House of Representatives today. So, yeah. Very, very, very hilarious news to report out of Indiana. And we're not done. We have a Trumpist federal judge by the name of Matthew Kaczmarek who ruled and said this week that drag is inherently sexual and should not be protected by the First Amendment. Now, this case comes out of West Texas A&M University in, I believe, Amarillo, where the chancellor of that university banned an 18th and up drag performance, and Kaczmarek sided with the chancellor here, and this is just another development in, you know, the culture wars over trans rights and trans existence. Now, I will caveat this by saying another federal judge struck down the state of Texas's drag ban in court just, I believe, yesterday or a couple of days ago after the time of recording. So, obviously, this continues to evolve. I think as of the day of recording, a drag ban got struck down in Montana for it not being constitutionally viable. So, again, obviously evolving, and the 2023 and 2024 elections are going to make a world of difference in how this country responds to issues about trans visibility and trans rights. So let me go ahead and make something very clear as we move to New Jersey. And if you're clued into politics, you know exactly why I'm going to New Jersey. It's what I'm going to make Sunday's episode about. Bob Menendez. Not even once. Good God. So that is where I'm going to end today's episode on that bit of a cliffhanger. Thank y'all for tuning in to this episode of Pulse of the Nation. We'll see y'all on Saturday for what could happen if Kevin McCarthy is booted from the speakership.
Any opinions expressed in this program are those of the host and do not represent the thoughts or opinions of 90.7 WVUA or the University of Alabama.
WVUA-FM, Tuscaloosa.